This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning for Morningstar.
Our guest this week is Tom Idzorek. Tom is Chief Investment Officer, Retirement for Morningstar Investment Management, which is Morningstar's affiliated asset management arm. Previously, Tom was president of Morningstar Investment Management, and before that was a leading researcher at Ibbotson Associates. Tom has collaborated on a number of influential academic studies on topics including asset allocation, the liquidity of stocks, and the role of popularity in security prices. Tom serves on the editorial board of the CFA Institute's Financial Analyst Journal. He received his bachelor's degree from Arizona State University and his MBA from Thunderbird School of Global Management. He's also a CFA charter holder. Tom, welcome to The Long View.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. Thank you so much for being with us. As we mentioned in the intro, you're the Chief Investment Officer, Retirement for Morningstar Investment Management. Can you talk about what your role entails day to day?
Sure. I oversee kind of two teams. One is what I'd say is kind of a quantitative research focused team that is really thinking about the different methodologies that we use across kind of our workplace business within Morningstar. And then kind of the second team is the team of kind of investment professionals, portfolio managers, analysts that are kind of carrying out the methodologies. And then our team interacts heavily with various, what I'll call like an engine creation team and or technology team that is often taking the methodologies that we create and refine and cooking that into scalable technology-based solutions that drive a number of our automated advice-oriented offerings.
So who have been some of your professional influences? I'm sure Roger Ibbotson and our former colleague Peng Chen would be on that list, and perhaps you can discuss your relationship with them and your roots in what was Ibbotson Associates, and then perhaps also discuss some other people who have been influential in terms of your professional development.
Sure. Again, I guess I started my, what I'll call my kind of financial career at a place called Zephyr Associates, and was hired away from there to Ibbotson Associates. And the person that, hired me was, one of the people that you just mentioned, Peng Chen. And so I went to work for Ibbotson Associates. And I'd say, had, some interaction, with Roger Ibbotson, the founder of Ibbotson Associates, who's at Yale at that kind of point in time. But, kind of my primary influence at that point in time was Peng. And, he was a wonderful, I'd say, kind of mentor and really, kind of believed in what I brought to the table. In 2006, as you all would know, Morningstar ended up, purchasing Ibbotson Associates from Roger. And, eventually, I ended up serving, as the president of Ibbotson Associates. And it was kind of after the purchase of Ibbotson Associates, by Morningstar that I'd say kind of my level or degree of interaction with, Roger Ibbotson, increased significantly. And we, as we'll probably get into later in the podcast, I've collaborated, both with Peng and Roger significantly since then, and they've been wonderful, influences. Thinking about kind of other, people, anybody that's been at Morningstar, as long as, all of us have, and, for me going back to 2006, of course, Joe Mansueto and Don Phillips, are just fabulous people to interact with, so smart, kind of thinking out beyond kind of the Morningstar circle. Back, I guess there was a firm, Barclays Global Investors or BGI that ends up getting acquired, by BlackRock. But, at BGI, there was a guy, Richard Grinnell and Ron Kahn, and they wrote a book called Active Portfolio Management. And I'd say that's just really been a big influence. I don't know Richard or Ron at all. But people that worked very closely with Richard Grenold and Ron Kahn are, you know, two kind of ex-Ibbotson Associates people, Barton Waring and Larry Siegel. And I would say both Barton and Larry have been very involved in a portfolio construction kind of framework that we use heavily at our business today and have used it, you know, for 20 years, which is an alpha tracking error optimization framework. But often when our opportunity set of investments that we're trying to combine into portfolio, you know, include what I'll call, you know, pooled investment vehicles, whether these are mutual funds or separate accounts or ETFs. And then I guess maybe circling back to Morningstar just a smidge, you know, I've had, you know, the good fortune of working with, you know, a number of, you know, really talented coworkers and co-authored a number of pieces with, say, James Zhang, for example, and Paul Kaplan.
Wanted to talk about output from your role. One important piece of that is managed accounts. We should mention again that, you know, a lot of your work is focused on the defined contribution space, and that's why it makes managed accounts a logical place to go next. I think it's fair to say you're a strong proponent for retirement managed accounts. Maybe you can talk about what a managed account is and why you think they have merit for retirement plan participants.
Sure. So, you know, a retirement managed account, and we should distinguish that from kind of a separately managed account, is really a flavor of a robo, you know, digital advice solution that people access typically through their employer's retirement, you know, kind of plan that is provided through, you know, kind of a record keeping service. And I would argue that kind of these retirement oriented, you know, robo advisors are probably more sophisticated than the current crop of robo advisors that people are probably more familiar with in kind of the retail setting, where I think of kind of the current grouping of robo advisors as, you know, being mostly, you know, you take a risk tolerance questionnaire, it, you know, slots you into a portfolio. And again, kind of going back to the retirement managed accounts, again, I think of it as being much more akin to the type of investment services that a financial advisor would offer, or, you know, even leaning a little bit towards what I might call financial planning, you know, light, where it is really trying to understand, based on the information that is available on the record keeping system, the individual investor's kind of unique situation, determine what their retirement need is going to look like, and that can be influenced by information provided by the participant. And then based on that estimated kind of retirement need, you know, make sure that they are on track for a successful retirement by, you know, evaluating, you know, kind of the progress that they're making towards that goal. Are they saving enough? You know, do they, when is an appropriate age for them to retire? You know, this type of solution, you know, contemplates not only the assets that are in kind of say their primary retirement account or DC account, but has the ability to contemplate, you know, outside assets. And again, so I guess I think of it as being, you know, kind of a wonderful advisor solution or advisor oriented solution, you know, for an individual who might not have access to a real world, you know, financial advisor.
You mentioned some of these other inputs that you would like to see in order for the managed account offering to be as robust as it could be. So like what sorts of outside assets does the participant have and so on. So how big a challenge is it to get clients to supply the data that they need in order for the managed account to work as it should? And I'm just wondering how you and the team have thought about like just trying to simplify that for participants so they can give you what you need to make a good recommendation.
Right. Again, obviously, you know, if you have more information about an individual and their kind of unique circumstances, the more personalized and more tailored and the better, I would argue, that your advice can be. Now, you know, kind of maybe before we get to what the individual can input via, you know, kind of the system, I will say, you know, kind of pleasantly, the amount of information that is available on most kind of retirement record keeping platforms has increased over the years. And so we used to just know kind of a handful of data points about an individual. Again, and, you know, it's kind of the types of data points that are available on the record keeping system, you know, have increased over the years. So in terms of, you know, what we need, that's great that we have that extra information. And then, you know, account aggregation or aggregators, you know, that's kind of a new thing that's out there. And our system is, you know, attempting to use our own integration system, which is a firm we, you know, purchased, which is By All Accounts. There's other aggregators out there that different record keepers have access to. And so there's a desire to automate what can be automated. Now, of course, there's probably a limit to that. And so that's where you kind of get into a user interface, user experience challenge as to how do you make it easy for that individual to supply you, you know, with information about themselves. And again, like I said, the more information that we have, the better that our advice would be. And I think the same thing is true. You know, if an individual went out to see, you know, a real world human advisor and they only provided kind of a limited set of information about themselves, you know, the advisor would do the best that they can on behalf of that individual, but it would be, you know, limited to what the advisor knew. And I'm afraid our system has kind of the same real world limitation that that advisor would have. And again, we are attempting to get that in an automated fashion and then augment that with what the individual would be willing to share with us.
So supposing you had a participant who was really forthcoming and able to provide you with the data that you need in order to enable the personalization and really tailor something to suit their objectives and circumstances, how do you think they should go about trying to quantify the benefits of the personalized analysis service that they're getting just so that they can better weigh the trade-off of a managed account versus something that's a little bit more off the shelf like a target date fund?
Right. Yeah, I think that quantifying, at least just let's say the personalized aspect of it, is definitely a real challenge. And I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I will say we did write a paper a few years back called, you know, Stop Guessing. And kind of the motivation for this paper was, you know, if I think about kind of just within the workplace area of Morningstar and the different product offerings is, you know, we have, you know, the retirement managed account offering, which is kind of the ultimate level of personalization, you know, beyond going to say a real world human financial advisor, financial planner. But we also offer, you know, kind of a plethora of what I'll call off the shelf target date funds, as well as at kind of the plan level, you know, something that's referred to as kind of a custom target date fund. And my guess is that if I went and spoke to, you know, the product manager of each of those services, they would all want to say, well, of course, you know, my solution is the most appropriate for, say, an individual or a given plan. And as a pseudo quant, I would say I dislike that type of answer and would love to be able to quantify in some sort of measurable, you know, terms, you know, is one of those solutions more appropriate for a given investor? And so if we kind of go back to modern portfolio theory as kind of put forth by Harry Markowitz, you know, there's the idea that there's a kind of a utility maximizing portfolio for a given investor. And if that investor is invested in, say, the wrong point on what you might think of as an efficient frontier, you know, they're not maximizing the utility for them because there's a mismatch between the appropriateness of that portfolio and the portfolio that they're actually getting. And so in the spirit of kind of that Markowitz utility maximization framework in the Stop Guessing paper that I'm talking about here, what we do is we attempt to say, you know, what is the utility provided by managed accounts under the assumption that it is finding the exact right portfolio for a given, you know, person and personalizing that in an appropriate way. And then if they were to be slotted into whether it's an off-the-shelf target date fund or a custom target date fund or somebody else's target date fund for that matter, some other third party, you know, chances are they aren't going to be at the exact right asset allocation that they should be as determined, say, by a retirement managed account. And by not being in the right solution, they're going to give up, you know, some level of utility. Now, typically, not always, but in most cases, that additional level of personalization offered through a retirement managed account comes at additional cost. And so what our framework is attempting to do is say there is a utility loss from not being in the appropriate solution, but we also want to focus in on what is the real world cost for retirement managed accounts. And so what this paper puts forth is this utility framework for trying to quantify, given a plurality of different, you know, potential investment solutions, which one is actually the best. And we're doing that kind of in the spirit of the Markowitz framework.
I don't think you're a fan of active management in general, but you'd probably agree that it does have its place in some situations. Where are the spots where you think it makes sense to perhaps use some sort of an actively managed product in lieu of an indexed product?
That's a good question. Like, they've all been good questions. So I almost want to be like a little bit offended. Like, am I not a fan of active management? You're, of course, in order for the markets to be reasonably efficient, right, we have to have some level of active management. And I guess I would love to be able to find great active managers that, you know, consistently, you know, outperformed after fees. And it's not that I'm not a fan of active management. It's just that, you know, boy, it is really, really hard to outperform, you know, on an after fee risk adjusted basis through time. And I guess I believe, you know, that very few people, first of all, I think there's, you know, very few good active managers, you know, that are going to truly outperform. And then I think kind of our ability as advisors, as investors, to find them ahead of time, you know, I think that's very hard. And I think, you know, kind of my takeaway from that is that most people kind of should throw hands up and then just, you know, really focus on kind of lower fees. You know, earlier I mentioned that, you know, my favorite book, you know, within kind of the investment world is Active Portfolio Management, again, by Richard Grenold and Ron Kahn, you know, which is kind of the art of attempting to outperform. So again, my favorite book. Again, it's just, that's the framework for doing it. It's just, you know, darn difficult. So again, I guess in the vast majority of asset classes, you know, I think most people should probably just be, you know, buying passive products at the lowest possible cost. You know, perhaps an asset class, and I'm not 100% sure it is an asset class, but maybe commodity futures would be one where I would tend to want to be a little bit more active. And so you have, you know, kind of these commodity future indexes and kind of, I'll call popular products for kind of getting that exposure, you know, exist in an ETF or in ETN. And to me, these ETFs and ETNs, you know, essentially need to track the underlying index. And I think this creates an opportunity where active investors or hedge funds or, you know, other CTAs, commodity trading advisors, are able to front run what these ETFs and ETNs are doing. So I guess commodities might be kind of the one, if we can call it asset class, where I would prefer active management.
So delving into asset allocation further, a key research interest of yours has been the role of human capital in influencing how we invest our financial capital. So has the pandemic revealed anything about human capital and the way we think that concept ought to be integrated into financial planning and asset allocation? And also, perhaps you can define how you think about human capital in this context.
Right. Yeah. So again, I guess I wish that individuals would receive kind of an updated, you know, balance sheet that kind of represented what I think of as kind of their total wealth and the nature of kind of what I sometimes refer to as their retirement income liability, recognizing that it may not be a legal liability, but again, most of us have a consumption series, even, you know, before retirement and then after retirement, that we want a standard of living that we want to maintain. Thinking about kind of the left-hand side of the balance sheet, which is, let's say, you know, the asset side of the balance sheet, it's very clear, I think, often what I would say is our financial capital. But for many investors, kind of their largest single asset is what we refer to as their human capital. And you can think of as human capital as being, you know, all of the earnings that they're going to make throughout their lifetime. And again, in our kind of model, we typically focus mostly on the portion of human capital that would be used to eventually pay for retirement. And so kind of our somewhat, you know, nerdy definition of human capital is it's the mortality weighted net present value of all future, you know, earnings that would be, you know, used, you know, for retirement. And then if you think about, say, Social Security, or maybe for the lucky few that have access to a defined benefit pension, you know, I think of those as a form of deferred labor income or another flavor of human capital. And then for most people, you know, we think of human capital, it's often a little bit more bond-like than stock-like. And we kind of arrive at that conclusion by, you know, thinking about the nature of the cash flows of that kind of saving series. And again, for most people, it is relatively stable. It's relatively more safe. And to the degree that people have more human capital, a safe asset that is going to help, you know, whether it's providing Social Security, a DB, or simply money that is getting saved or converted from human capital into financial capital. Again, this is a wonderful, somewhat safe asset. And I guess to tie this back, you know, to part of your question, you know, dealing with, you know, has the pandemic, you know, changed kind of our view of human capital? I don't know that it's changed kind of our view on it. I think something maybe that it's highlighted is that, you know, we often assume that people are going to continue to work, you know, throughout, you know, their lifetime. And something that we've seen during the pandemic here is, you know, a number of people have at least temporarily, if not permanently, decided to leave the workforce. And so kind of our working assumption that most people will be working to some, you know, kind of retirement age of, say, 65 or whatever it happens to be for them, I'd say maybe need to revisit that a bit.
Well, I wanted to ask about that because it does seem like younger people, and this is a huge generalization, but it seems like there's some embrace of like lumpier income streams, that people are not hooking up with an employer and staying there for many years. They're, you know, perhaps a little bit more entrepreneurial. They seem more willing to put up with variability in their cash flows. Do you think that'll influence how you make investment recommendations for people in that situation?
I think it probably should. And again, I think that we're always trying to learn and improve our models. I will say, you know, it's probably a good sign that, you know, young people and, you know, have, let's say, I'll call it the flexibility to choose to have that lumpier work stream. You know, again, this isn't everybody, of course, but that sounds, you know, great that one can have the flexibility to choose maybe to take a year off from work, where, again, I think that, you know, for those of us that are a little bit older, you know, the mindset was, is, you know, you always had to be working and striving for that savings. But in terms of the way, you know, we're trying to, I would say, design the ultimate financial advisor, ultimate financial planner in a box with our kind of team, you know, of PhDs. And we want our advice to be as prudent, as suitable as possible, and reflect the way investors actually behave. And again, I think this is highlighting kind of a new flavor of behavior.
This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
As you know, interest rates have been rising amid higher inflation. For the first time in quite a while, investors are having to deal with losses in both the stock and bond sleeves of their portfolios. Do you think investors ought to be thinking about adjusting their portfolios so as to better withstand rising rates and inflation should that arise in the future?
Jeff, probably. Again, I guess to me, the ideal time to have adjusted your, you know, asset allocation in your portfolio probably would have been before the increases in interest rates and inflation. And I'd say that that is something that we try to cook into kind of our lifetime asset allocation policies and the way we evolve our intra-stock and intra-bond detailed asset allocations within our retirement managed account, you know, platform, as well as kind of the target date solutions that we provide. You know, a technique that I would say institutional investors, especially, you know, maybe pension plans and endowments that think about, you know, funding, you know, some sort of, you know, liability. You know, a technique that is often used there is liability relative investing, or a flavor of liability relative investing is liability relative optimization. And you can think of that as kind of being an extension of the Markowitz mean variance optimization, except when you're running your optimizer, you have constrained the optimizer to hold either an asset or a combination of assets that represent what I would think of as the systematic characteristics of that liability. And so, you know, if I think about an individual investor and what is their income stream or desired expense stream kind of look like in retirement, to me, most people in retirement have this thing. It's almost as if they've issued a TIPS bond of some sort where they have to kind of pay out an ongoing real expense. And you might think of that as one way of thinking about their liability. And then as one ages, the duration of that bond, you know, shortens. And we use this liability relative optimization framework, and we attempt to model the changing nature of the cash flow structure of somebody's, you know, retirement expenses, capturing kind of the interest rate risk and inflation risk associated with that liability. And an outcome of applying that type of optimization is for somebody that is, say, nearing retirement or in retirement, you are somewhat attempting to match with your bond portfolio, you know, the embedded kind of inflation risk and interest rate risk that would be embedded in that. And you can somewhat offset that with your detailed fixed income portfolio. I'm not saying you can fully offset that, but again, ideally, the right time to have thought about the risks that are, you know, inherent in the world that people face, you would want to create your asset allocation in such a way that you would have contemplated raising interest rates and rising inflation prior to actually occurring.
So I would just like to ask, so what would the portfolio look like if the goal is to defend against those future threats of rising rates and inflation from a practical standpoint? What are the things that retirees could think about having in their toolkit and acknowledging that they'd want to be preemptive rather than reactive in adding those positions?
Right. Well, so, you know, if you think about life expectancy, for example, and maybe you're, you know, 60, 65, life expectancy is, you know, it's relatively long, you know, 30 plus years. And so the duration of those cash flows is pretty long. And so one may actually, you know, want to have a reasonable amount of duration in their portfolio at age 65. But as you, you know, move to 70, 75, 85, and the duration of those cash flows, you know, becomes lower, you know, you would decrease the amount of duration exposure that you have within your portfolio. And so this would, from an asset allocation, this would be, you know, a movement from, you know, a portfolio that it may have been more intermediate term bonds and or, you know, some sort of, you know, long-term bond exposure from an asset class perspective into something that is probably more a mix of, you know, money market, stable value, short-term bond, and probably a mix of intermediate bond and phasing out, you know, kind of long-term, you know, bonds as somebody ages. And then, you know, kind of thinking about kind of the split between nominal bonds versus TIPS or inflation-linked bonds. You know, earlier you'd asked Christine about kind of human capital and the nature of human capital. You know, one of the things that we like to think about is how do the two big elements of the left-hand side of that balance sheet, your financial capital and human capital, kind of evolve through time? You know, younger investors, the left-hand side of their balance sheet is dominated by human capital. And I would say, again, earlier I described human capital as being a safe asset, but it also, you know, provides an inflation hedge. You know, most salaries tend to go up, albeit with a lag, during periods of high inflation. And so younger people who are primarily also invested in equities have a lot of kind of built-in inflation hedging into their kind of overall total wealth portfolio. But then in retirement, when, you know, on a relative basis, human capital is probably much smaller, and the primary mechanism for which people are going to pay for retirement is by drawing down their financial capital. Again, I would argue again that their asset allocation should evolve in such a way that they are well positioned to fight the risks that, I want to say, you know, inflation is always a risk that people face. Inflation has been very low for a long time, and now it is definitely ticking up. Whether it'll continue to do so or not, you know, remains to be seen. But, you know, high inflation erodes the purchasing power of somebody's portfolio. And so in terms of, you know, kind of their bond allocation as somebody is nearing retirement and moving through retirement, I would argue that a larger and larger portion of their fixed income side of their portfolio should be implemented with inflation-linked bonds as opposed to nominal bonds.
I think that we could probably ask you questions about asset allocation for hours, but I think in the interest of time, maybe we'll pick your brain a little bit on retirement planning and specifically the 4% rule. Curious, as somebody who spent a lot of time thinking about researching not just accumulation of assets, but also orderly withdrawal of assets in retirement, what's your take on the 4% spending rule? Do you think it remains a good rule of thumb for retirement spending, or do you think it needs to be rethought in some ways?
Well, I almost should turn this question around and ask you guys. I know that the both of you, along with John Reckenthaler, recently did kind of a deep dive study on the 4% rule. So I guess, you know, as a back of the envelope heuristic, in terms of thinking about what you might need, that seems reasonable. But I think our, you know, whole need for kind of this type of heuristic in an age when we have calculators and systems that can do a much better job of determining, you know, is somebody kind of on track and what can they spend and how do you factor in a variety of other things such as Social Security, a DB, whether or not they have access to annuities, what's their tax structure look like. One can just use, again, a machine, and of course our retirement managed account engine and machines, you know, do all of this, could do a much better job of determining is somebody on track to meet their goals. And if they're not on track, how do you course correct? Or let's say that they were being overly conservative and wanted to spend more money, one could figure that out as well. So I guess I kind of think it's an unnecessary heuristic at this point.
You referenced annuities, Tom, and I'd like to dig into that a little bit. What role do you think they should play in retirement planning and for whom? And also, what types of annuities would tend to be most beneficial in your view?
Right. That it is such a complicated question. And I think for some people, you know, annuities absolutely can and should play kind of a role in their retirement plan. I believe, you know, many advisors and planners, you know, kind of come down on kind of one side of the fence. They either kind of love annuities or they hate annuities. And I guess I would just say I have a nuanced view. And, you know, people, you know, in retirement, depending upon how well they're funded, you know, they may or may not face, you know, kind of a significant amount of longevity risk. So I've talked about interest rate risk and inflation risk, and now I guess we're going to talk about longevity risk. This is another risk that people face, and to the degree that they face that risk, we would want to provide some level of protection against it. And now, you know, if you're fortunate enough to, you know, have Social Security and a defined benefit pension meeting the vast majority of your, you know, kind of income need in retirement, chances are you don't need an annuity. You know, conversely, there's a number of us that will probably save, you know, just enough so that we will, you know, run out of money right around kind of life expectancy. And if that describes you, well, the risk that you face is you're going to live, you know, 5 years too long or 10 years too long, and you've run out of money. And annuities can absolutely provide you with that form of kind of longevity, you know, protection. And so a challenge when speaking about annuities is that there's so many different, you know, flavors. A type that seems to be, I'll say, unpopular, but one that I think is, you know, excellent is kind of the immediate annuity, where, you know, somebody that is in retirement, whether they're 65 or 70, would exchange a lump sum in exchange for income for life. And now, for probably a number of reasons, you know, that behavioral finance would have to try to explain, you know, people are often worried about that large exchange of control of a lump sum of money in exchange for income for life. And so another, you know, popular flavor of annuity that isn't quite as efficient at producing kind of income would be a deferred variable annuity with a guaranteed living benefit rider attached to it. And now that provides people with the flexibility to, you know, sell off the remaining account value should they choose to. So they have that liquidity flexibility, if you will. But of course, doing so erodes any longevity protection that they would have had. And so, you know, I would argue that if you're contemplating, you know, a purchase of a deferred variable annuity with a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit or living benefit rider, you should absolutely be viewing that as a purchase for life and really kind of adhere to the income that it provides and not erode what is referred to, you know, as your benefit base.
I wanted to ask, if I may, about another sort of benefit that I suppose we could liken to an annuity, which is Social Security. Do you think enough is being done on Social Security optimization? The decision on when to claim by itself can be pretty complicated. So what's your take on that? Do you think that's a missed opportunity for many who are planning for retirement, that they haven't really thought right through how to optimize Social Security?
Sure. You know, and I think that's probably for the people that kind of mess that up, right, are the ones that aren't working with something like our retirement managed account service, or they're not working with an advisor or a planner. And I think that, you know, kind of the mistake, if you will, that the biggest mistake that most people would make is that they just, you know, go ahead and take that Social Security payment as soon as possible, when many of them, you know, would benefit by simply delaying.
We wanted to discuss some of your academic research, which has received a lot of acclaim. For instance, you co-authored a paper with our colleague James Shong and Roger Ibbotson called The Liquidity Style of Mutual Funds. That one won the prestigious Graham and Dodd Scroll Award from the CFA Institute. Can you talk about the paper's key findings and implications?
Sure. So I guess we wrote this paper after Roger and some of his other co-authors had written a paper, you know, kind of looking at individual stocks and the impact that liquidity seemed to have on the returns of those stocks. And so what Roger and his colleagues did is, I think they went back to, I think it was either 1970 or 1972, and they took all the U.S. equities, and each year they formed them into either quartiles or quintiles, I can't recall, based on their estimated level of liquidity. And then each year rebalanced. And they found that, you know, monotonically, that the, you know, quartile or quintile representing kind of the lower liquidity stocks, and these are still very liquid stocks, they're just less liquid than let's say the most liquid stocks, you know, systematically outperformed. And then in our paper that you mentioned, you know, with Roger Ibbotson and James Zhang, you know, we were wondering, could you see the same kind of effect in mutual funds? And so using, you know, the Morningstar category system within the different categories, we looked at whether we'd see the same thing. And so we basically sorted within a category the mutual funds by their estimated liquidity level of their holdings, and then formed, again, I believe it was quartiles, possibly quintiles, across all categories that we looked at, the mutual funds that were holding the less liquid stocks systematically outperformed those within the same category, the mutual funds that were by and large holding higher liquidity stocks.
And so that paper was published, I think, about a decade ago. Can you update us on the research? You know, one of the things that's been striking about the last 10 years or so, as we think about it, is until relatively recently, small caps hadn't fared as well versus large caps. And I tend to think of large caps as maybe more liquid, small caps as less liquid. And so how has it held up over the intervening years since you published the paper?
So we haven't really updated those exact numbers. And Jeff, that would be, you know, an interesting thing that we probably should do. You know, something that's been interesting over the last 10 years, right, is, you know, large cap has done exceptionally well. I would say in general, right, large cap is often more liquid than small cap. I guess to me, you know, this is where kind of my journey, along with, you know, Roger Ibbotson and Paul Kaplan, and to some degree, you know, James Zhang, is why is it that liquidity would seem to explain returns? And of course, I guess I would say that, you know, this relates to kind of our, you know, developing theory of the theory of popularity, and then eventually, you know, an asset pricing model, the popularity asset pricing model. And again, I think it makes sense that all else equal, right, all of us would prefer more liquidity to less liquidity. And because we all share that same preference, right, and some of us really have a stronger maybe liquidity need than others, again, I would say that in general, some investors are willing to kind of pay up. You might think of that as a premium purchase price in order to hold an asset that is more liquid. And, you know, this could describe active managers, people that have purchases upcoming. Again, people in general like liquidity. And we kind of have turned that to other, I'll call it, characteristics that investments may have. And in general, any characteristic that the vast majority of investors tend to, let's say, like, that tends to move asset prices somewhat. And investments with desirable characteristics tend to be able to, you know, kind of trade at a bit of a premium relative to investments that have, I'll call it, unpopular characteristics.
Well, Tom, you've referenced the work that you've done on popularity, asset popularity. Can you talk about how you defined popularity? And also, can you tie that back to the work that you've done on liquidity?
Well, again, I guess I would just think liquidity in and of itself is a characteristic. And any characteristic that is popular, chances are it's going to be more expensive, all else equal, than a characteristic that is unpopular. And I think that you could, you know, apply that to kind of a wide range, you know, of characteristics that are embedded or coupled with investments. And so taxation of different investments, you know, people that are taxable investors, all else equal, right, they would prefer investments that are more tax efficient. You know, kind of thinking about glamour stocks, I think that there's a number of people out there that really like the big names, the glamorous names, and kind of want to avoid, you know, it's kind of the boring names. And arguably, kind of the degree to which a given characteristic is more popular or less popular, that ebbs and flows kind of with time. And, you know, part of that reflects kind of the business models that people think are more attractive than others, per se.
Yeah, I wanted to build on that and ask you about ESG. How does ESG and maybe non-financial objectives in general, how does that tie into the concept of popularity, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's a wonderful topic that is very much aligned, let's say, with popularity. And I, you know, when I think about ESG, you know, I think that people tend to think of it as either being, you know, a financial or pecuniary perspective. And, you know, is global warming, is green, is that better for business? And so that would be thinking about it, let's say, from a pecuniary perspective. And then there's this kind of non-financial or non-pecuniary perspective in which, kind of regardless of impact it may or may not have on risk and return, do I like a given characteristic? And so, you know, I think of E, S, and G as being, you know, characteristics of an investment. And then, of course, within the E, the S, and the G, you could drill down and, you know, subdivide that into a wide variety of other characteristics. And again, from a popularity perspective, you know, to the degree that people like green investments, firms with good governance, et cetera. And the degree to which people are liking that, the number of investors that are liking those characteristics, you know, that can create upward price pressure on things. So again, I think, you know, ESG fits very nicely into the popularity, you know, framework. And you can think of, you know, kind of popularity as having this, if I maybe switch over from kind of popularity to maybe the more formal popularity asset pricing model that we've developed, you would be able to think about, you know, investments can have different expected returns and risks. And within the popularity asset pricing model, each investor should be estimating and including all kind of relative risk factors in terms of, you know, how do they think about risk and return. And if I believe that a variety of E, S, and G, you know, characteristics or factors will influence risk and return, I should incorporate that into what I'll call my capital market expectations when optimizing a portfolio. But similarly, or, you know, conversely, maybe at the same time, the popularity asset pricing model allows for people to have these preferences or tastes. And based on their tastes, they can also derive utility. So, you know, you always want to build a portfolio that's maximizing utility for you. And that should reflect both how you think the pecuniary aspect of ESG as well as the non-pecuniary aspect of ESG.
Well, I wanted to follow up on that. If someone is owning ESG in an effort to kind of minimize those ESG risk factors, should they expect to have to give up something in return for that? Should they anticipate that they'll have lower returns?
I'm going to say probably, right? Like, risk is risk. And so if we kind of go back to, you know, Harry Markowitz and mean variance optimization, modern portfolio theory, you know, Dr. Markowitz didn't tell us how to come up with kind of our inputs for mean variance optimization, but presumably a good analyst should be considering any and all relative factors that influence risk and return. And to the degree that those are ESG factors, again, that are, let's say, you know, relevant to impacting risk and return, those should be included in one's analysis. And, you know, a key takeaway, I'd say, from modern portfolio theory is that, you know, lower expected risk should result in lower expected returns. And to me, that makes sense. And now, if I kind of put a popularity lens onto this, if the overall popularity of ESG investing is on the rise, so there is a kind of a shift in the equilibrium in terms of the overall demand for ESG-centric assets, you know, as that shift in popularity occurs, that could, you know, result in a period of time when, you know, lower ESG risk-oriented investments might temporarily outperform, but at some point you'll reach kind of that new equilibrium state, and now you'll simply be paying, you know, kind of up for something with desirable ESG characteristics, including lower ESG risk. And I think a reasonable expectation in the long run would be, you know, lower expected return.
Wanted to shift gears and ask you about advice. You have lots of experience sort of thinking about delivering financial advice in sort of automated, scalable ways. You've alluded to that in different points in the conversation, but you've also worked with a lot of advisors over time. So my question is, with respect to human being advisors, where do you think they could be most helpful in, say, the accumulation years and working with clients? And then also, when it comes to retirement income, you know, what do you think is the most sort of beneficial thing that they could be doing for their clients to help them navigate through those years?
All right. I don't know that I have a good answer for that, Jeff. I think that the most important thing, right, is that the individual is in fact working with an advisor, whether it's a human advisor or a robo-advisor. And, you know, the key thing, right, is that the advisor is, you know, whether it's human or robo, is going to assess, I think, is that person on track to meet their goals? And if not, you know, what do you do? And again, kind of maybe getting into something that, you know, a human advisor can do really well that a that a robo-advisor, you know, can't do is, you know, market volatility is inevitable. You know, we know that kind of these, you know, 20% declines, let's say in the stock market, you know, they seem to occur on average, you know, based on our Morningstar data, about once every 7 years. So quite frequently. And the worst thing, again, that, you know, investors could do is panic and leave the market. And something, you know, human advisors are great at is helping coach their clientele through those times of market volatility.
Well, Tom, this has been a very enlightening conversation. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us. We really have enjoyed it.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thanks for doing it, Tom.
Thanks, Christine.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you could, please take a minute to subscribe to and rate the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
And at Christine_Benz.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.